And now Natalie will address us.
Thanks, Gina. That was beautiful. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." I made a firm decision to always honor that, and I'm honored to be here today to share my experiences of the 60s with all of you. One person can make a difference, and one act can make a difference. I grew up in Cincinnati, the gateway to the South. Our school, elementary school, now they call it middle school, and it was a big building with a statue of Lincoln in the front of it. And we had three classrooms for every grade, and then we had the shacks outside. We called them the shacks. They were for the overflow. The very smart children were in the A class. The pretty smart kids were in the B-plus class. The smart enough kids were in the B class. And except for Leonard Stockton, all the colored kids were in the shacks. I just remembered Leonard Stockton last night. I woke John up to say, "Oh, yes, I remember." So they couldn't be sued for having the black kids separate because there was always Leonard Stockton. So over the bridge, over the suspension bridge across the Ohio River from Cincinnati was Covington, Kentucky. And during the Civil War, Levi Coffin was president of the Underground Railway. And each year during the Civil War, he helped 100 slaves for 33 years to escape to Cincinnati. And in the 60s, when I was a young wife and mother, I was the director of the Head Start program. And my office was in Lincoln Heights, which was an all-black community. And I became very involved in civil rights. And when the African-American people went to the restaurant, they were told it was closed. And then we went in and we were served. And we took it to court and we won. When they went, they were supposed to sit in the balconies of the movies, of the theaters. And so when they went, they were told to go to the balcony because there was no more room left downstairs. We went in, and they seated us, and we took it to court, and we won. The same thing happened with the swimming pool in Coney Island and the skating rinks. So every time we took it to court, they went in first, they were told they were closed, and then we went in, and we were served, and we won every time. Many years later, 3 years ago, John and I were campaigning for Obama, and we were teaching young new voters how to register and where to go register. And this wouldn't have happened if we hadn't marched and protested in the 60s. So to tell you now about the marches, in 1963, 49 years ago, 100 years after Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, 250,000 of us marched in Washington. 60,000 of us were white. And we marched for jobs and freedom and voting rights. At that time, mostly African American people could only get jobs as maids and porters and janitors. And they also went to inferior schools in the South where they had torn books, used books, or no books at all. And when the children in the South marched, fire hoses were turned on them. So in Cincinnati, we took a train to Washington to march on the Capitol. The whole train was filled with marchers. From Cincinnati to D.C., every car was filled with marchers. And we marched side by side, blacks and whites together. Trains kept coming in from all over, people singing. We had so many wonderful singers and actors. We had Odetta, Mahalia Jackson, jazz, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Marlon Brando, Paul Newman. And Marian Anderson was supposed to sing the national anthem to begin the march. But because of all the conglomeration with buses and trains, she was late. And so Josephine Baker, who left this country, she was an expatriate. She left this country because of the way African Americans were treated. And yet on that day, she sang the national anthem. When Marian Anderson came, she sang, "He's got the whole world in his hands." And Roy Wilkins, president of the NAACP, said, "You've got religion here today. Don't backslide tomorrow. Take it home to your cities." 1 million military soldiers were there, but there was no need. There were no disturbances. John Lewis, the coordinator of the Student Nonviolent Committee, said, "If the government doesn't give us equality, we'll take it in our own hands." Dr. King persuaded him to change his words to a peaceful talk coming from love. Dr. King said, "Never peace times. There's more to be done. Peace is more than the absence of conflict. Peace is the presence of justice." 2 years later, in 1965, we marched in Selma. Before we crossed the bridge to Montgomery, the Alabama police troops gave us 3 minutes to disperse. John Lewis had his skull fractured. Others fell screaming. Violence did occur, but only by the police. Blood was flowing everywhere. 20 people were hospitalized. It was Bloody Sunday. We left to stop the violence, and President Johnson sent in the National Guard to protect us, and we marched across the bridge to Montgomery. Whites from Selma stood on the hill and yelled obscenities to us and threw rocks at our heads. I still have a bruise 47 years later. We never fought back. We followed Dr. King's teachings of nonviolence. Some of us had been studying and attending workshops of peace and nonviolence all over the country. Reverend McCracken taught our Unitarian Fellowship, and the good feelings were contagious. People new to the Gandhi, Martin Luther King philosophy easily became part of the community and felt the love and peace in our hearts. I felt my heart opening as I marched and sang with all those other people who had the same passion I had for peace and justice and equality. We felt peaceful and fulfilled, and many of us felt compassion for the white Southerners who were so angry. Our marshals stood along the roads to keep the peace. They had armbands that said peace and justice. They were mostly African-American young men who were trained in Martin Luther King's church in Montgomery and at other churches in the South. 25,000 of us marched in Selma. That's more than the whole population of Ashland. We marched 12 miles a day for 3 days, 6 people across, arm in arm. We sang "We Shall Overcome" and other peace songs, other freedom songs. We slept in churches, African-American people's homes, and in fields. And African-American people who lived in nearby shacks and farmhouses brought us sandwiches and water. One time, some of us had to go to the bathroom, and we went into an African-American woman's house. And she said, "Are you a medical doctor?" And I said, "No, why?" She said, "Well, they're the only ones who know that we're all the same inside." Another time I was marching with a young man, a young African-American man, and he said, "You know, white skin feels the same to me as dark skin. Doesn't seem to make any difference." He said, "It's the first time I've ever touched white skin." Another time when I was marching, there was a very old black man, and I dropped a napkin. He stooped down quickly to pick it up before I had a chance to, and he said, "We don't want any white trash here except the white trash that's already here." We were neat and polite and peaceful through the whole march. We didn't break any laws. One afternoon, I was marching with a beautiful white woman from Detroit named Viola Luizzo. We became really good friends marching together all afternoon, and we decided we would continue our friendship and we would meet each other after the march. We were very thirsty because it was hot and dusty, and we hadn't had water for a while. And two young African-American men with peace and justice on their arms came by in a car, and they said they need another person so they could carry some water jugs. And I wanted to go, and I started to get in the car, but Viola pushed me aside, and she got in the car. We never saw her again. She was shot and killed by the Ku Klux Klan for riding with black men in a car. As we marched, we noticed there were separate bathrooms that said white and some said colored. There were separate drinking fountains that said white and colored. And we didn't want to honor their separateness, so we all went into the colored bathrooms, but the toilets didn't flush. We also tried the colored drinking fountains, but some of them didn't work. We saw the rundown schools. Some of them had used books with other kids had scribbled on them, and some of them didn't have books. Reverend McCracken said, you know, Dr. King would be a wonderful president. And Reverend Shuttlesworth, who was a well-known black civil rights minister who died just a few months ago in his 90s, he said, no, the whites will never let that. They'll never let a colored person be president. Now, he just died a few months ago, so he did get to see it. At the end of our march, when we arrived in Montgomery, Dr. King said, the end we seek is a society at peace with itself, a society that can live with its conscience. I know you are asking today, how long will it take? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment, however frustrating the hour, it won't be long. After his speech, we went to the restaurant in the airport because we were really hungry and thirsty, but we were blacks together, so they wouldn't serve us. We kept Dr. King's philosophy. We said to the waitress, thank you for telling us in such a nice way, and I know you have to keep your job. We left and went out the door to get on the plane to go back to Cincinnati. And she came out with a big jug of water and a big bag of cookies, and she said, you've really taught me some things. I didn't understand what this was all about. I see it differently now. I'm on your side. On the plane, we all took an oath that if ever we heard anybody saying anything against any group of people, we would all speak out. Martin Luther King was against the Vietnam War, so he lost President Johnson's support. Dr. King said, I fought too hard against segregation to segregate my moral concerns now. If he were alive today, I think he would be a peaceful warrior against those wars that are waging. In 1965, after the Selma March, I helped organize the Cincinnati March. And sharecroppers in Tennessee who registered to vote were kicked off their farms. So they came to Cincinnati because that's where the federal district court met. And Reverend McCracken asked me if some of them could stay in our house. Yes, I said yes. It was a wonderful experience for my children. Then he said to me, Reverend McCracken came over and he said to me, could two other civil rights leaders from Atlanta stay at your house? Yes. Dr. and Mrs. Martin Luther King stayed at my house. Gina told me she thought she would cry, but I didn't think I would. One morning, the first morning when I came down to make breakfast, Martin and Coretta were praying, holding hands by the breakfast table. And the second morning when I came down, they had set the table. They always said please and thank you to each other and to us. And one evening when Martin came to the library, my library, he said to me, thank you for reading the books you read. The night Martin was killed, my phone kept ringing, and then I answered the phone, and it was Jimmy Vinegar, and he was the president of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. And he said, I'm calling you, Natalie, to tell you not to go out of the house tonight. They're having a vigil in Lincoln Heights, and I'm afraid a black a white person could get killed. I said, I have to go be with my people in Lincoln Heights. And he said, well, then I'll pick you up and I'll stay right with you. So we went to Lincoln Heights that night. And I got the best compliment of my life. One of the mothers who was an assistant teacher came over to me and she said, you look white, but you're good. I think you have a black soul. Knowing Dr. King changed my life. He taught us to be nonviolent, keep peace in our hearts, kindness in our actions, and he taught me to open my heart and go deeper to my very soul. Thank you so much for listening to my story.